Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? And his most recent book that we talked about last time was Global Crisis, National Renewal, A Grand Strategy. Welcome, Charles.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's always my pleasure.
Great. I thought we'd do a discussion today on some recent blog postings that you've done on your blog of twominds.com. And one is called The Real Revolution is Underway, but Nobody Recognizes It. And another blog post is entitled, Should You Move While You Can or When You Must? So maybe we can begin with the first one. You see like a real revolution happening, but you're emphasizing that nobody's really seeing it at the moment. Maybe we can start with some of the aspects of that blog post.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Well, my basic thesis here is that, you know, the majority of people are sort of primed to look at the idea of revolution as a political process. In other words, there's a political party, there's a new political party, there's some political movement, right, that takes place within the political realm. And what I'm suggesting is that the this revolution has no direct political expression. It's not a political revolution where somebody's trying to put in a different party or a different set of leadership or whatever. This is a revolution in the economy, which is going to have political implications, but it's not a political revolution. It's a revolution of people dropping out or opting out of a lifetime of low wages and or high taxes. If you have a high wage, then you're paying a huge amount of tax. If you have a low wage, it's not a living wage. And so in the US, there was a professor who coined this term, the Great Resignation, because he started to see after the lockdowns ended and the economy started going again in 2020, he started seeing a huge number of people quitting and looking for other opportunities. And other people have commented on there's a large number in the US of new IRS business numbers, you know, like tax ID numbers being issued. So there seems to be a very broad-based and dynamic revolution occurring in the labor market. People are either cutting their hours, not going back to work, dropping out, starting their own business, getting by on gig economy type informal employment. And so one direct consequence of this is that corporate America as a general, group of employers, the large employers, they're not able to fill all their slots. And there's some evidence, that there's like as many as 12 or 13 million open jobs. And so I think this is extremely interesting because there's a lot of data out there. And I'll share the charts that are on the blog, or you can grab them and post them with this podcast, that basically capital has siphoned about $50 trillion from labor since 1975. In other words, all the gains of this of the economy essentially went to the top 1/10 of 1% and a little bit into the top 10%. But the wage earners actually saw their purchasing power decline significantly. And those of us who are old enough to remember, you know, the 70s and when we were making like $3 an hour, you'd say, oh my gosh, you must have been poor. And the actual fact is we actually lived better on the wages we made in the mid 70s than we do now in terms of what our money can buy. And so this labor revolution is quite interesting because it's going to have a tremendous impact on demographics, tax revenues, and the social order, because people are also not just deciding to seek opportunities for themselves, they're also kind of resisting this sort of status quo here. You know, the status quo is go out there, work 40 or 50 years, pay, you know, go to college, you know, rack up $100,000 debt, spend the rest of your life paying down debt, buy an overpriced house, then spend the rest of your life paying that down. And so it's this sort of debt-based rat race kind of lifestyle that is burning out millions of people, right? It turns out that it's just not human. It's inhuman. And so there's a lot of resistance, if you will, to the status quo. So that's why I call it a revolution.
Yeah. And just to mention, this is essentially effects of what we would call as financial repression, namely from the central banks in terms of their policies, their money printing, quantitative easing, which makes the money that is created available to those that are closest to that money creation, namely in the financial sector. So it doesn't really go to the Main Street, but the ones that are, or it doesn't go to Main Street as much, but mainly to the financial sector in large preponderance. And so that has caused this large wealth and income inequality. It's been a big contributing factor in that sense. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely, Richard, is that the people who were already wealthy by buying assets such as stocks and bonds and homes and commercial property, 30 years ago, they've just gotten richer. And then meanwhile, young people are coming into the world and then being told you got to borrow a ton of money for, you know, a university degree, that's the value of that's devalued. And so they no longer can buy these assets as cheap as the generations before. And so they're at a huge disadvantage. So it's a generational kind of ripoff, if you will, because it was, you know, if you bought assets, you know, 35 years ago, well, all you had to do was hang on to them and you're rich. And then meanwhile, what about young people? They don't have the same opportunity. And it's exactly because, as you say, by printing a huge amount of money, they've created trillions of dollars that can then be used to bid up the value of assets way beyond what they were worth in terms of, you know, hours of labor, you know, 35 years ago. But I think we should also mention that that it's part of the political corruption as well as the central bank financial repression. There's political repression in that. A big reason why small employers can't afford to pay people a living wage is they're saddled with all these cartel and monopoly expenses. And here in the U.S., that a big one is, of course, healthcare. And that in a recent post, I described it because I was an employer in the mid 80s, which was, you know, roughly 35 years ago. I used to be able to, buy full coverage, healthcare insurance for my workers for like $50 a month for the single employees and like $160 a month for the families. And according to the official inflation rate, that $50 is like $132 today, meaning that if healthcare insurance had gone up along with official inflation, I should be able to buy an employee's insurance for $132 a month now. Well, actually, it's like the average is now $600 a month. So this is what happens when you let your economy become dominated by cartels and monopolies or quasi-monopolies, right? And so healthcare is basically bankrupting the United States, and it's bankrupting it on multiple levels. But in terms of small business, it's you know, you're paying an exorbitant amount of rent, because part of the financial repression you mentioned is once you create this huge, you know, a sum of money for financiers and corporations, then they can outbid each other to buy the commercial property. And then once the commercial property has been purchased for, you know, millions of dollars more than it's worth, then you've got to raise the rents, right? So that the, and of course, who's renting these commercial properties? Well, a small business to a large degree. So at least to some degree. So you're paying cartel priced rent, you're paying cartel priced healthcare, you're paying a lot of junk fees to the local government, business license taxes and all this other stuff. And so the small employers, it's like very hard to pay your employees enough because you've been strip mined by the cartels and taxes. So that's part of why it's been difficult for labor to catch up. But now labor is catching up because there's a shortage of workers or a scarcity. And it's interesting, Richard, because a lot of people feel like, well, that's going to be automation. But automation is going to, you know, wipe out all the need for human employees. And my first response is, well, you know, the company that's pursuing automation most vociferously is Amazon, with its warehouses and, you know, millions of boxes and all that stuff, which you'd think would be very amenable to automation. And they do have a lot of robots wandering around their warehouses, but they still need 360,000 human employees. So automation isn't quite as easy as the non-automation experts seem to assume. So there is a real labor shortage, because it isn't that easy to automate as many jobs as people seem to think. And so this scarcity is now allowing labor to demand a little catch up to all the loss of purchasing power over the last, you know, 35, 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. And so if we look at your charts, which are great in that blog post, you've got one underneath the Great Resignation on a list of why workers are seeking new jobs in 2022. So the list of the reasons, number one on that is seeking better pay, benefits. You know, you referenced that a lot in what you've just mentioned. Another is find a job I'm more passionate about. Poor working conditions at current job. Want to continue working remotely. Start my own business. COVID concerns, obviously, that's a big one in the post-COVID era. Care for children. To avoid COVID vaccine mandates. That's a big one, right, with all the vaccine mandates in certain sectors, certain industries, don't want to continue working remotely. So yeah, there's an extensive list of the reasons why workers are seeking new jobs in 2022. Any comments on that or observations?
Yeah, it's I'm glad you mentioned that, Richard, because it goes to show that this is a broad-based movement. And I'm proposing that much like wage inflation, I don't think any of these are transitory. I don't think any of these are simply a artifact of the post-COVID era or anything like that. I think this is a multi-year, possibly multi-decade cycle change. You know, just as interest rates have declined for, you know, 40 years and are now ticking up, and inflation has been, you know, very tame, at least officially, for 20 years, and now it's now taking off. I think we're in a cyclical change here. The cycle has turned, and now labor is in a position to start clawing back some of what it lost over the last 40 years. And so we could anticipate that over time, corporate profits will probably decline as they have to pay more. And there's more clawback in terms of workers' control. Because you see in a lot of this, the list, it's a lot about agency. In other words, it's control of one's life and career, and also being able to say no to abusive employers, right? That working conditions in a lot of corporate America jobs are horrendous. They're really poor, right? Basically, corporate managers have been able to sort of abuse the workforce and demand, you know, long hours and low pay because there was a surplus of workers and or people willing to work. And now there's a shortage of people who are willing to work. And so labor can now demand better working conditions. And we see this in both high level and low level jobs. In other words, it's not just hotshot programmers and Wall Street young bankers that are getting huge raises. You're seeing service workers get big raises because there's a lot of jobs in America and in the developed world, which are difficult, ugly, dirty. And if you can't find people to do that work, then society grinds to a halt. You know, nobody wants to work at the sewage treatment plant or the water treatment plant or collect garbage, or then your society comes to a halt. And so that's another factor here. And I think one last thing is, you know, people have sacrificed their families and their personal lives for their job, for their corporate America job, right? They're on 24, you know, most of the day. They have to answer emails at midnight. Their families have suffered because, all, you know, if once you get enslaved to your job, then you no longer can pay attention or, you know, nurture your own family. And so a lot of people are voting to reduce their hours, or one spouse quits their job in order to be able to devote proper attention to their children. So I think you add up all of these and it becomes something that's affecting tens of millions of workers, not just millions.
Yeah. And so we have the situation of this trend, this great trend called the Great Resignation. And it's for a number of reasons, as we mentioned. That leads us to your other article posting that we want to explore. Should you move while you can or when you must? Because, you know, a lot of these reasons why people are resigning is leading them to perhaps move to a different location or set up a different type of living arrangement or living process or, you know, so let's go into that, you know, in terms of what would happen. So should you move while you can or when you must? So what was your thinking on that blog post?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Well, I think it is absolutely right. And I think you and I have touched on this, that once the revolution in remote work, you cannot put that genie back in the bottle as much as corporate America wants to, at least some sectors want to kind of force people back into the office. It doesn't make sense for the employees. And so once you can work remotely, then that frees you from having to live in proximity to, you know, the office or your headquarters. And so that gives you a lot more freedom. And so then you can start thinking about living in more pleasant surroundings. And not be tied to heavy traffic commute and in these very dense urban zones. And I think I was also looking at the decay in urban America as a broad-based sort of statement. And I think you can say that some of this is visible in cities across the developed world. It's where government has become so expensive that that the tax rate inside these cities is really high. And then the so-called benefits of living in the city, like the social life and entertainment and all that, it took a hit in the lockdown, and some of it's not coming back. And also there's a sort of a cyclical rise in crime. And so you no longer are as safe as you once were in a lot of urban zones in America. And then because the governments are inefficient and bloated with complexity, like building permits and so on are so complicated and arduous and time consuming, that the infrastructure is falling apart in a lot of urban zones, right? That they're falling behind in just maintaining water and sewage and roadways, affordable housing, you name it, right? And so as the cities fall apart, it's like the benefits decay to the point where, why am I even tolerating this situation? Like, I'm paying very high taxes. I'm no longer feel safe. All the fun things that we used to do have been truncated, or it's unsafe to get there. And there's homeless encampments everywhere. And it's not that the homeless are the problem. It's that the individual household can't solve that problem. You know, I mean, it's like, it's so large and so complicated and so profound that, you know, the only choice for an individual is to just get out of that circumstance. You're not going to be able to solve homelessness up that's a block away from your house. You know, that's not within your power. And so moving is pretty much the only agency that a lot of people have.
And yes, you mentioned this migration from getting out of the cities and into perhaps suburbs or exurbs and into the countryside. What about international migration as well? Do you see this playing out here as well?
Yeah, that's interesting for the sort of upper the upper echelon of households who can afford to look beyond, or retirees that are looking abroad. And there's certainly a great increase in conversations about that, right? I mean, you see a lot more like on medium.com or on the alternative media, and even in the mainstream media, you see a lot more articles and commentaries about moving abroad, pro and con, right? And so that shows that there's interest. Now, whether the physical number of people leaving North America for Central America or Asia, I don't know. I haven't seen any statistics that indicate it's rising, but the interest is rising, and that's indicative of future behavior, right? First, we think about it and we talk about it and we discuss it, and we do a cost, you know, benefit analysis, and then we take action. So part of what I was suggesting in this article is, right now, you know, with the economy still kind of staggering along and the social order sort of decaying but still kind of glued together, you know, you have a lot of freedom to move still. You can sell your, you know, house or apartment in the city for a reasonable amount of money and take that capital and move it elsewhere. But if things start really unraveling, you know, like crime really takes off, the social order sort of starts unraveling, and there's runaway inflation, or there's a collapse in, you know, overpriced, you know, real estate, then your options are really going to be truncated. And so it's like the advantages are to the first movers. In other words, the people who move first get the best price for what assets they sell, and they have the best choice of options, you know, in desirable locales elsewhere in the world. And so if you wait until, you know, the value of your house has fallen 50% and all the nice places have been snapped up by the wealthy, you're just going to have fewer options. And so that's what I'm suggesting is move. If you're going to move first. Don't be the straggler. Mm-hmm.
And you see this all coming to a head in 2024 to 2025. What was the thinking behind that, and why those particular dates?
Yeah, well, that's thank you for that question, Richard. And you and I have had discussions, you know, mostly off recording about Martin Armstrong and his long, you know, history of charting cyclical changes, you know, like sort of change in the tides of the economy and society. And we've talked about Peter Turchin's 50-year cycle and the fourth turning theory of four 20-year cycles that add up to an 80-year cycle, you know. And so I think there's a strong case to be made that we're in a cyclical change of tides here in the early 2020s. And that a lot of people seem to think that the status quo is so durable that it's going to just last for, you know, decades, and there'll be plenty of time to kind of fool around with, you know, things on the margins. I am more of the opinion that when cycles change, they gather momentum and and velocity very quickly. And so, like, for example, the collapse of the Soviet Union, as there's the book title, a book about the sociological aspect of the collapse of the USSR, it's called Everything Was Forever Until It Was No More. And so I think that there's an element of that that I think once things start unraveling, that and we've talked a lot about, you know, the excesses of financial repression and extremes of debt and extremes of political repression, all of these extremes will tend to unravel much much more quickly than it took to build up that those stresses, if you will. So I think that if we are in fact in a fourth turning or a turn of a 50-year cycle, it's not a 20-year process. It's more like a 5-year process. At least that's what history suggests. Mm-hmm. And so if this whole thing kind of kicked off as Martin Armstrong, I think, identified January 2020 as a turn date. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to recall it was he had a date there that I think things are going to unravel very quickly, at least to the point where people are going to start really thinking through making dramatic changes in their lives.
Yeah. And it does seem that they are taking steps. I mean, all of these writings, in particular these two blog posts we're talking about today, it does seem to be indicating that people really value their happiness, their freedom and liberties, and just trying to do what is best for them to, you know, to make them happy. And so it's essentially, as I see it, a movement away from what is trying to be enveloped in terms of the World Economic Forum Great Reset, which seems to attempt to change people's behavior or even try to change human nature. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting, Richard, because from my analysis, and which I describe in my book, you know, Global Crisis, National Renewal, I mean, I think human nature is basically focused around a community, right? That humans are social animals and we value community. We value a community that we belong to, that values us, that values our contributions and so on. And sharing, reciprocity, all the benefits of community. And the status quo is all about taking a job, making some billionaire richer. I mean, that's kind of my sort of quick, that's what the economy is globally now, right? You slave away for decades. You might make some money, but your labor is constantly losing purchasing power for all the reasons we've discussed. And so you're basically just making the owners of capital wealthier. And that's not really true capitalism, right? Because capitalism is about destruction of failed businesses and inefficiencies. And instead we've elevated inefficiencies and profiteering, you know, via cartels and monopolies. And so the other part of human nature is agency. That's the sociological term for having control of one's life, right? And having options and being able to pursue opportunities. And so I think that the World Economic Forum's idea is, let's take away everybody's agency and denigrate community and make everybody beholden to central states and regional governments and that kind of thing, that you're supposed to just kind of become a consumer, like a passive consumer, and take your universal basic income and kind of scrape along. And you won't own anything, but you're going to be happy because we told you you're happy. And so that, I think I totally agree with you that I think people taking control of their lives and exercising agency to exit and opt out and drop out of the status quo is a way of dropping out, not just of their job or their career or their locale, but it's dropping out of the entire status quo, which in my mind is kind of being a debt serf and a tax donkey, and surrendering, you know, your agency to the government or your corporate, you know, employer. So if you're going to start working in your own small business or having a homestead or figuring out how to get a living in the gig economy, you're taking control back into your own hands. And I think that's the revolution.
Yeah. And the what you've written about in the past applies a lot to where we're at now. Many of your books, and I mean, I would say from my perspective too, a general theme would be to be as independent as possible, to minimize dependency, especially on government, either government programs any types of assistance that they may have going, because then, you know, you continue in that sort of serfdom, as you mentioned. But as just an end note, the last question, if you can just positively give some of the principles that you've written about in many of your books, you know, what in terms of jobs, decentralized type of systems, if you can relate that would be a great ending.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Well, I think the phrase I like to use to describe that whole nexus is the community economy. And what I mean by that is a relocalized, localized economy that's decentralized simply because it's basically functioning in the local production, as opposed to being completely dependent on global production, you know, 5,000 miles away. So it's focused on local control of capital, local investment, local production, in other words, of food, energy, essentials. And I like to use the term a community economy because if you've ever been in a real community and you've been a small business owner or a gig economy worker, then you know that people actually are working together. Now they're competing, you know, in a friendly way. In other words, it's not like you're trying to destroy your, you know, somebody else that's got a booth at the farmer's market or another building contractor. It's like there's enough for everybody, and you're actually sharing resources and ideas and improving your community economy. You're creating jobs, you're producing goods and services. And so this is like a place to all of humanity's strengths, right? We do like friendly competition. You know, that's what sports is about. But we also like to share ideas and capital in a way, right? Social capital and also, you know, physical capital. And so this is, I think, the future of a productive, humane kind of society is to focus on the community economy. Make it work for people in your community, you know, create jobs, opportunities for capital, opportunities for entrepreneurship. And that's how we'll prosper, is to relocalize, you know, labor, capital, and control, and take it away from global capital.
Yeah, exactly. Let's call it the Great Awakening.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow, great insight, Charles. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com, and you can download a free, the first 30 or 40 pages of my most recent book and previous books, and read them for free. And all my archives are free too.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Charles.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, and we'll end it there.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.